to talk about some things as to the topic that of the thought of having a place of refuge. And if we can just simply announce it, a place of refuge, but perhaps we can call it, I have a place of refuge, because I want to work my way to that particular point in just a little while. For the moment, let me just mention a thought or two with regard to some ideas that we may see in the scripture for those places that were places of refuge. They were not places of refuge for everyone. They were not those places of safety. They were not those places of comfort or joy. But there were such places for some people who would abide by the rule, if you will, and would take advantage of that which had been offered. And so as we begin, and I could want to use just some simple illustrations for us tonight, and one of them, then, if we may just simply think of Noah's Ark. And as, by the way, I don't think that's the way it looked, but that's only for, get your attention for a moment. But at any rate, as we think of the matter of the Ark, you know that through the years, and if we think of the history of man, there were various kinds of places that were used and as hiding places, as places of refuge in that sense, like David hiding in a cave, perhaps. And through history, we've found that many men have used that kind of a place. Today, we happen to think of our houses as somewhat or our places of abode, as places that can be refuge, and we can get away from the world. And as I'm still trying to get acclimated to the traffic and such that goes along with that in the Chicago area, it's about like stepping on an anthill every time one steps out of all the motion and all that goes. And when I get home, I feel such a relief. I feel like my house is a place of refuge from all of the hustle and bustle and all of that traffic. But we're going to look at this in a little different way as we go back to the book of Genesis and read about Noah. And if, of course, as we recall in Genesis, it tells us that just 10 generations away from the creation and away from the first man, that man was so sinful that it grieved God that he had even made man. And we have referred to Genesis 6:6 a number of times this week. The Lord was sorry that he had made man on the earth, and he was grieved in his heart. And so God said that he was going to do something. The Lord said, I will destroy man whom I have created from the face of the earth, both man and beast, creeping thing, birds of the air, for I am sorry that I have made them. And thus God was going to destroy. And yet we see something else taking place here. The very next verse says, but Noah found grace in the eyes of the Lord. And thus God gives him a command. In verse 14, make yourself an ark of gopher wood. And we remember that he gave him directions with regard to the dimensions and how it would have one door and one window and those kinds of things. And as he gave him all this direction then of that which he was to do, we see that ultimately then came the great flood. And when that flood came, there was then a flood that was going to cover the highest of the mountains, some 15 cubits. And when this was done, and as it was done so to the extent that all then the large earth life was destroyed, except for that which had been taken with Noah upon the ark. For him, then, the ark was a place of refuge. It was a place of safety. And all the destruction that was going on about them, this for him was a place of great safety. And we remember that Peter refers to this event, and he says that 8 souls were saved by water. Now we are reminded of the great destruction that went on around it, but there was for Noah and his family a place of refuge. It was a place that could be theirs, this great place of safety, because they followed God's directive in this regard. Then as we turn to the book of Exodus, we're moving on in Old Testament history quite a ways, because we're going as we had 10 generations to Noah and another 10 generations to Abraham, and then Isaac and Jacob. And we find the children of Israel down in Egypt when Jacob was a very old man, and his family, that is his children, their families all went down. And they were there for something like 400 years, perhaps 430 years. And then they were going to be released. And you remember that there was a request to let the people go. Well, Pharaoh was not about to do this. Here was this slave labor that he had. And there were a number of reasons, perhaps, for him to maintain the status quo. And he did not wish to let the people go. But God was ready for them to be released. And so, through Moses, and then came that the famous 10 plagues. And ultimately came that one where there was the death of the firstborn in Egypt. And in order to spare some of them, then there were a number of things that were to be done. And there was a preparation for this. And as there was to be no leaven in their houses, and there was to be certain foods eaten. And then in Exodus chapter 12, at verse 21, Moses called for the elders of Israel and said to them, "Pick out and take lambs for yourselves according to your families, and kill the Passover lamb. And you shall take a bunch of hyssop and dip it in the blood that is in the basin, and strike the lintel and the two doorposts with the blood that is in the basin, and none of you shall go out of the door of his house until morning." And so there was a place of refuge for them, of something that was about to take place. "For the Lord will pass through to strike the Egyptian when he sees the blood on the lintel and the two doorposts. And the Lord will pass over the door and not allow the destroyer to come into your house to strike you. You shall observe this thing. It will come to pass when you come to the land which the Lord will give you, just as he had promised, you shall keep this service." But as the thing that was going to happen here then is with regard to all the houses of Israel, that the Lord struck the firstborn of the land of Egypt, from the firstborn of Pharaoh who sat on the throne to the firstborn of the captive who was in the dungeon, and all the firstborn of livestock. So Pharaoh rose in the night, he and all his servants and all the Egyptians. There was great cry in Egypt, for there was not a house where there was not one dead. And to this we would just simply say, except. And that is that where there had been the preparation made, where they had followed that law, and where they had followed that directive of God, then the firstborn would not die. For all of them, it was a place of refuge. And all throughout Egypt, there was great mourning. There was great loss throughout the land. Because as we think of the great losses that these people suffered, even though the very thing that here that spared the children of Israel was a signal for the destruction of the others, these are the children of Israel did indeed find a place of refuge. To use another illustration, we turn to the book of Numbers. And in the book of Numbers, we read about a situation that came because of those who, under certain circumstances, could be spared, and a life for a life not be the rule. It was an eye for an eye, and a tooth for a tooth, and a life for a life. But there were certain times, as in the case of, let us say, with regard to an accidental death, that one could go to a certain place, and these were called the cities of refuge. In Numbers 35, at verse 13, "And the cities which you give, you shall have six cities of refuge." And it seems that there were some three of them on either side of the Jordan. And as these were set, there were certain conditions on which they could go there.
And it was one who was classed as a murderer, could not, but if there had been a cause and an accidental death, one could go to that place, and he was to remain there for his lifetime, or at least that of the high priest. But the point is that here, if one had taken the life of another, a family member might take vengeance on him, except for the one who was in this city of refuge. Thus, if he would go to that place, and there was a hiding place, a place of safety, a place of refuge for him. One who was not here, one who did not take advantage of that which God had provided, his life might be lost. But these were taken so that there could be, and the refuge for them, the place of safety for them, was simply in this city, and or one of these six. Here is just a simple plan that God had provided for them, and if they would abide by the rules of that plan, then it could be for them and should have been for them, thus a place of safety. Let's use a New Testament example for a moment. If you turn to the book of Acts, and this is an interesting story here because of all the drama that is involved with it. In this is after the three preaching journeys of Paul, and after he is back to Jerusalem and there arrested. And you remember that he had appealed to Caesar. And having appealed to Caesar, at one point it was thought that he could have been let go except for the fact that he had. And of course, this was one of those catch-22 type things, in that had he not appealed to Caesar, that he would have been in difficulty. And now, having appealed to Caesar to spare himself, now he cannot be released. And so he is on now a prison ship, and he is being taken to Rome. And as he was being taken there, you remember that a great storm ensued. That's kind of an interesting thing to read this story, and to tell how that as they had come. Come to this place, and they were hoping then to make time. But Paul gave them warning and suggested that they should not. And he advised them, saying, "I perceive that this voyage," I'm sorry, I'm reading from Acts chapter 27 at verse 10, when he would say, "I perceive that this voyage will end with disaster and much loss, not only of the cargo and ship, but also our lives. Nevertheless, the centurion was more persuaded by the helmsman and the owner of the ship than by the things spoken by Paul." And Sterling, we all know about that, wouldn't we? What would a preacher know anything about ships? And so he would listen to somebody else. And after all, it was the owner of the ship and the helmsman, and these fellows should have known something about it. But at any case, we see that the warning was here. And Paul had given the warning. And then, because the harbor was not suitable to winter in, the majority advised to set sail from there also, and they might reach Phoenix, a harbor of Crete, opening toward the southwest and northwest, and winter there. And so we find that they did set sail. But they run into trouble almost immediately. And as they do, you see the great storm, that they could not see sun, nor moon, or stars, and thus they had no way of knowing really where they were. And they could not calculate their locations. And so it comes then that there's going to be a breakup of the ship, and they recognize this. And Paul said here that he gets a message first. As we read at verse 21, "In long abstinence for food, then Paul stood in the midst of them, saying, 'Men, you should have listened to me and not have sailed from Crete and incurred this disaster and loss.'" And I guess Sterling, being a preacher, he couldn't help but saying, "I told you so." But at any rate, he does remind them of what he had said. "And now I urge you to take heart, for there is no loss of, there will be no loss of life among you, but only of the ship. For there stood by me this night an angel of the God to whom I belong and whom I serve, saying, 'Do not be afraid, Paul. You must be brought before Caesar. Indeed, God has granted you all those who sail with you. Therefore, take heart, men, for I believe God that it will be just as it was told me. Now, there are some other particulars that are involved here, but the thing is that they were to stay with the ship. And some sailors were seeking to escape the ship when they let down the skiff into the sea under the pretense of putting out the anchors. But Paul said, unless these men stay in the ship, you cannot be saved. And then the soldiers cut away the ropes of the skiff and let it fall off. And the ending of that story, you well remember, is that as they drove it aground, the ship did break up. They then went down, those who couldn't swim, and grabbed various of the flotsam and so forth. And when it was all over, we find that all of them made it to shore safely. And it was said, and it was told, that they all escaped safely to land. Thus, it was just exactly as Paul had said, when they would remain with the ship. And now, in this sense, it was a place of safety. Now, for some, it may not have been all that obvious. And it may not have looked like it. This was the obvious thing, and the very thing that they really ought to do. And yet, what we see here is that God had spoken, and as Paul then relays the message that God has said, and when they did as God had said they should do, even though it was not obvious to men, even though it did not have that point of clarity in their own minds, they nevertheless did as was given by Paul, and they did all arrive safely. They all landed there very safely. Now, I've used these, and I've used these rather crude and simple illustrations just to kind of hold our attention and maybe allow the eye to aid the ear for a moment and embed in your minds some real interesting thoughts. That in each of these things, each of these being the ark or the houses where the blood was on the doorpost or the cities of refuge or Paul's prison ship, that in each one of these there was a directive of God. And when God's directive was followed, those who followed that directive and were in each of the particular places of refuge were saved. Now, with that in mind, I'd like to suggest to you some thoughts then further with regard to some places of refuge for us. And there are some two or three things that we need to think about in that regard, and some of them rather close together, perhaps. And I want to use this in another way, in thinking that this we ought to be able to think of home and family as being a place of refuge. Now, when I started off, I used the thought of my house. And indeed, there are times when my house may seem like a place of refuge. When I've been in heavy traffic and in one of those 35-mile-long parking lots, and when the nerves are frazzled out there on the superhighways and so forth, and you get in and you slam the door and all that is outside, and that does seem like a place of refuge. But I want to suggest to you there's a significant difference between the house and a home. And what I'm talking about now, right now, and this moment, is not houses, but homes. And when we're thinking of it, you know, I see signs all too often out in the area saying homes for sale. I don't know how, well, really, those people don't realize what they're saying with that. But I wanted to tell you, I'm afraid that is too often the same, that true, that there really have been homes for sale. And folks, I don't know you, so you know this is not an indictment of you personally, but I'm afraid there are too many of us who have sold our homes. And we have been trying to give both warning and encouragement as we've been speaking this week and thinking of the fact that there have been so many who have done so very much. I'm astonished and how many, as I have traveled about, and how many of my generation have lost their children. And how many that we see that the kind of thing happening. Not very long ago, my wife and I were discussing a particular family, the husband and wife, as good a people as one would hope to meet. They are godly, goodly people, it seems to us, as far as we're able to measure those things. And as we have been in their home and they in ours, And as we had traveled to see them and would willingly do so again and open our doors at any time, we knew that they were coming our way. But as we looked at them and their situation, where there were five children, four sons and a daughter, and the four sons are all lost. And I was talking to a couple of elders that knew the family well, and I said, what happened? How is it that these goodly people could have lost their sons? And one of the men just hung his head. And he said, when they were younger, they were too busy. And now it's too late. I ache for that family. Those children found places of refuge that were offered them in the world. Those children needed refuge, and they found it. But the parents weren't the ones that offered it until it was too late. And this can be repeated time and time and time again. Edgar A. Guest wrote a poem long ago that I want to read to you now. And it's called Orphans of the Living. We think of orphans only as little girls and lads who haven't any mothers and who haven't any dads. They're grouped with other children, and in groups they're put to bed with some strangers paid to listen while their little prayers are said. All the grown-ups look with pity on such lonely children small, and declare to be an orphan is the saddest fate of all. But sometimes I look about me and with sorrow hang my head as I gaze on something sadder than the orphans of the dead. For more pitiful and tragic, as long days come and go, are the orphans of parents they're not allowed to know. They're the orphans of the living, left alone to romp and play from their fathers and their mothers by ambition shut away. They have fathers who are busy and so weighted down with cares, they haven't time to listen to the little child's affairs. They have mothers who imagine life would give them, if it would, something richer, something better than the joys of motherhood. So the children learn from strangers, and by strangers' hands are fed. And the nurse, for so much money, nightly tucks them into bed. Lord, I would not grow so busy that I cannot drop my task to answer every question which that child of mine would ask. Let me never serve ambition here so selfishly, I pray, that I cannot stop to listen to the things my children say. For whatever cares beset them, let them know I'm standing by. I don't want to make them orphans till the day I come to die. I've read that a good many times, and I confess I'm moved by it every time. When I think of what it is saying, and this man certainly had a grasp of the society that was about him, but think of our society. Children deserve better than this. And homes and family ought to be a place of refuge. My wife was teaching a class of youngsters and was giving an illustration one day, and she said something like to the effect of sitting down and eating a meal together. And she noticed a reaction that one of the girls had had, or some kind of a reaction, and so my wife called upon her and said something, asked her if she had something to say, and she didn't at that moment, but a little later it came up again about, and she asked a question or two, the child did, about eating together, and she asked, does your family eat together? And she told them yes, and of course not at the noon meals of work and school and such would interfere with that. But we made sure that every evening, at least, that all of us were together at the same time and having our evening meal. That we would talk together, that we prayed together, and there were a number of things that we did. And there are some others in the class that echoed that, and then their families, they did the same thing. And then the question was asked her, well, do you, one of the other girls said, well, don't you people or your family eat together? And she said, well, sometimes on Sunday, all of us eat in the same room. Sometimes on a Sunday. And I was very sad when I heard that case, because there was not the unity that was in that home. And by the way, since that time, that home has turned into an absolute disaster. There have been a number of things. Mother and father are no longer married. There are children out of wedlock. There are many kinds of social and school problems. And on it goes. For these, home was not a place of refuge. One night, one of these girls showed up at our door at 9 o'clock, and she asked if she could come in. She was very cold. I forget the month, but it was in the wintertime. It was a sister to the one that I was just referring to. She had not been home since school. Hadn't let out at, 3 or 3:15, whatever. And she had been walking around in the neighborhood and among friends, and as various things and events came along, she would then go to another friend's house and to another until finally there was no place left to go but home. And when she got there and reached her house, all the doors were locked, and she couldn't get in. And it's such a sad thing to think of that kind of treatment, and our children deserve better than that. And certainly we as families deserve better than that, and God intended for us to do better and to be better than that, so that our homes will truly be a place of refuge. I think about how back along time ago, as God was speaking to Abraham, or speaking of Abraham, and with regard to the kind of person that he would be, and what God would expect of him to do, and it was said, "I know him," and that he would teach his children. And as Genesis 18 at verse 19, God said of Abraham, "I have known him, in order that he may command his children and his household after him, that they keep the way of the Lord to do righteousness and justice, and the Lord may bring Abraham to what has been spoken to him." And this he knew. And here was the Abraham, as the one, as we think of the great patriarch, we think of him through whom all the nations of the earth would be blessed. And here in this passage, he is commended by Jehovah because he will train up his children in the way they should go. And that it would be a place of refuge. His home would be a place of refuge. I remember sometime later, as Israel was on the brink of going into the promised land, and God had spoken to, of course, Moses for a long time, and then Joshua became a leader of the people. And he told him how that he would have a success. And as we read from the book of Joshua, and there in chapter 1, we see that he would tell him what he should do about his own, that is God's law. Joshua 1:8, this book of the law shall not depart from your mouth, but you shall meditate in it day and night, that you may observe to do according to all that is written in it. Then you will make your way prosperous, and then you will have good success. Now here, think of it for a moment. Here is the leader of a nation. And here is a rule of success, if you will, for the nation and for him as a leader, as he would take that nation and to lead them as God would have them go. A mighty leader for God. In chapter 24, at verse 15, Joshua says to the people, "If it seems evil to you to serve the Lord, choose for yourselves this day whom you will serve, whether the gods which your fathers served that were on the other side of the river, or the gods of the Amorites in whose land you dwell. But as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord." I want you to notice something about this. He didn't say, "We will, unless our favorite program comes on." He didn't say, "Unless it rains, unless Aunt Susie comes in from Birmingham." He didn't say any of this. He said, "We will." It was a determination. Somebody could have questioned him on it. But I want to emphasize, folks, the approach that Joshua took when he said, "We will. As for me and my house, we will." Please, folks, I beg you. You must. Souls are too valuable. Souls are too precious. The soul of husband and wife and child is too precious to waste on the devil. We must serve well, that our homes be saved. I heard the other day about Brother Randy Blackaby overseas. His family's at home, and he sent back word that he was homesick. I know the feeling. Been there, done that. Know the feeling. So when I spoke to our Brother Blackaby here the other night, last night in fact, I said, "Well, like," he asked me about how things were going, and I said, "Well, like Randy, I'm homesick. After 38 years, I'm anxious to get back." And young people, I don't expect that to ever change. And I want to tell you something. If the next 38 go like the last 38, I'll die a happy man. Because that's the kind of woman that I married. And she's made that home for me a place of refuge. And for our children, it was a place of refuge. And I want to say this as gently as I can, with no intent to cause any offense whatsoever. But I want to make a plea. And that is that if you have a spouse that is not a child of God, that you work on that very hard. And you teach that spouse whom you love. I cannot think of walking into my house, seeing the woman that I love, and look her in the face and know that she was lost. I could not bear it. Some time ago, my wife and I were in a house that a woman had invited us to. And her husband was there. Her husband, not a Christian. And as she had invited us there to talk with him and to visit with him, and we had a very pleasant visit. But after a little time, he then, out of habit, just automatically reached over on the table and picked up a pack of cigarettes, and he shook one out, and he began to tap the thing and go through all the motions that such do. And then when he started to lift it to his lips, she finally spoke, and she very gently said, these people have allergies and the smoke will bother you. And he apologized, and he said, I'm terribly sorry. He said, I didn't mean to do that. I'd had it made my mind up I wasn't going to do that. And he said, it's such an old habit. And he said, a filthy habit, really. But he said, and he was very apologetic for it and laid it all down. Now, I've given you that background to give you this. She said, this is the only thing we disagree on. Have you heard what I said? Have you heard what she said? Her husband, not a Christian, and the cigarette, she said, was the only thing they disagreed on. I thought my heart would crack right there. I can't imagine. I can't imagine that being the only problem in that kind of a situation. I can't imagine having such cold feelings. But that's all that would come to my mind at such a time. We need to make our homes a place of refuge where there can be the kind of spiritual activity that is represented by coming in. When my sister and I were growing up, our parents saw to it that every preacher traveling through town stopped in our house. We lived in Minneapolis, and so there were many businessmen who came, and as they traveled through, my parents invited in people from all over the country, the east and the west and the south, and they all came in because they wanted us to be exposed about them. And the dinner table conversation was about the church in their city, and how, when was the last gospel meeting, who preached there, and how have you been in teaching your young people, and all of these questions. And they wanted us to hear their responses and to listen to these people and to be exposed to these things, and that we might have a spiritual interest in them all. Our place, and I can thank God that for us, in our household, due to my father and mother, our house was a center of spiritual activity. Surely, as we can see, the man is a physical and spiritual being. He's a dual being, and God then has made provisions for us and given to us responsibilities and obligations in both realms. And by the same token, with regard to the family, whether it's we're thinking individual, but the family itself is that quite a bit of that nature. And I want to suggest to you that there can be a great many things that can be going on in the family circumstance that has to do with this spiritual nature. And finally, then, the last point I want to see on this one has to do with the church, which is also a family. And we've talked about that through the week, as we would think of it in the sense that not only should our homes be a place of refuge from the world, and where our children and where our husbands and wives and family can come together in support of each other, but certainly there is that family that we call the Lord's people, or if you will, the church. It ought to be a very comforting thing. And the thing that happened to me when I was about a teenager meeting in Minneapolis, I still remember 1401 First Avenue South, and we were there, and after services one morning, a man sitting about the third row from the back had his hat on the seat next to him, and after the amen, he grabbed his hat, turned around in the aisle, and as he clapped his hat on top of his head and headed for the door, he said, thank God that's over for another week. What a pity. Our coming together ought to be a place of refuge. It ought to be a place of strengthening. As we come together, think of all that the Lord has given us and the privilege of coming together as we teach and admonish one another in psalms and hymns and spiritual songs. Teach, admonish, encourage. In the Hebrew writer, chapter 10, verse 24, when he said that we stir up one another unto love and good works. Earlier this week, we talked about those one another passages, how we love one another, forbear one another, that we encourage, we build up, edify, And that certainly that we forgive one another and that we bring ourselves together in a great bond of love and peace because we are God's children. You know, when I look out at my neighbor and he throws his trash over the fence, you know, into my yard or something, or he runs over my dog or whatever, I have problems with that I'll try to deal with it the best way I can. But we're on all together different standards. And I look at him and I recognize here's a man that doesn't love God, doesn't know about God, won't let me talk to him about God. But when I look at one who is my brother in Christ, I'm working with a different standard. I'm working with one who knows the love of God, who knows what it means to be forgiven, who can stand in that bond of peace and can stand together with me in the hope of heaven. And when I look at that one, I am looking not at my neighbor, but I'm looking at God's child. And he deserves better than the evil doer. And I need to do that. And I need to be a part of the building up and the part of the encouraging of him. When I read of the unity that Paul speaks of in Ephesians chapter 4, and he speaks there of it this way. I, therefore, the prisoner of the Lord, beseech you to have a walk worthy of the calling with which you were called, with all lowliness and gentleness, long-suffering, bearing with one another with love, endeavoring to keep the unity of the Spirit in the bond of peace. You know, sometimes it just seems like where we go there, we can find somebody that always keeps the pot boiling and always keeps something stirred up. My Nigerian brethren have an interesting comment that, you know, some problem will come up and somebody will shake their head and say, well, I didn't expect that. And they'll say, well, out of every 12, there must be a Judas. Maybe that's a little rough, but on the other hand, it makes a point. But you see here, the apostle is talking about, just as he did to the Corinthians, how that there be a unity, be the same mind, the same judgment, they speak the same things. Here he's talking about the one body and one Spirit and one Lord and one faith, one baptism, one God and Father of all. And as he talks about these things, he's saying that all of you who are in this bond, you endeavor to keep the bond of unity. You endeavor to keep the unity of the Spirit in the bond of peace. Why? These were God's children, and that's the way they needed to conduct themselves. I remember that in reading in Acts chapter 2, where these who had first obeyed the gospel, and it tells how they continued in these things together. And there was a great togetherness for them and by them, and we find Acts 2:41, those that gladly received the word were baptized, and there were about 3,000 that first day. Verse 42 then says, they continued steadfastly in the apostles' doctrine and fellowship and the breaking of bread and prayers. They continued with each other, reinforced each other in their new faith. And verse 47 tells us that these people were praising God and having favor with all the people, and the Lord added to the church daily those who were being saved. Literally, and if you read from I believe it's the New American Standard Version, it says the Lord added to their number such as were being saved. You know, the famous ecclesia that our preachers like to use, ecclesia is not in this passage in the original, in the Greek language. But literally, it is added to their number. And so when we're talking about this number that belonged to the Lord, and as they added to that number, so it is that they were bonded together. And as they were reaching out together toward heaven. For no one, for where I am in Palestine, for our brethren who meet everywhere, it is my prayer that there would be this great unity in Christ, that we would recognize that there is something far beyond self. That there's something far larger than self, and that we ought to submit ourselves to the righteousness of God, recognizing that our brethren are worth saving, and these are those for whom Christ died. two passages. First is in that found in Philippians chapter 2. And here the apostle says, therefore, if there's any consolation or encouragement in Christ, if any comfort of love, any fellowship of the Spirit, if any affection of mercy, fulfill my joy by being like-minded, having the same love, being of one accord, of one mind. Let nothing be done through selfish ambition or conceit, but in lowliness of mind, let each esteem others better than himself. Let each of you look not out only for his own interests, but also for the interests of others. Folks, if we can follow this formula, we will see ourselves being strengthened. We will see ourselves growing. We will see ourselves heaven bound. As Paul, as we read from him a moment ago from the Ephesians, I thank my God for you all. And may God bless you. As we close this lesson, let us be mindful of an invitation that was given ever so long ago. An invitation given by our Lord. God loved us and sent his Son here for us to benefit us. And Jesus then gave a great invitation. Come unto me, all ye that labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest. And as we read his invitation given to us in Matthew 11:28, when he would say further, take my yoke upon you and learn of me, I am gentle and lowly in heart, and you shall find rest for your souls. If you would have rest from sin, even tonight you may confess Jesus as the Christ, the Son of the living God. And as a penitent believer, you may be buried with him in that watery grave of baptism. And you may come forth from that grave in the likeness of his resurrection. And that new life will be yours because the relationship has changed. Once an alien, now then a part of the great family of God. Part of this, as we were illustrating in the last chart there, with regard to being part of the Lord's people. Part of those who have been added to that great host, been added to that number of the saved.